I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. In 1960, the relatively new technology of television transformed the presidential campaign, sending a young, handsome, and charismatic John Kennedy straight to the White House. In 2004, the new technology is the Internet, and nobody's using it better than Howard Dean. Hard to say at this point how far it will carry him, but the Dean campaign has already energized so many supporters and raised so much money that Dean may forego federal campaign funds and the rules and restrictions that come with that cash to go toe-to-toe with President Bush in raising private money. True to form, Dean is asking 600,000 of his supporters to make that decision online by midnight tonight, with the results to be released tomorrow. So here's the question to you. Is the Dean campaign's use of the Internet a shining example of democracy in action, or does it just help build a cult of personality? Will Dean's Internet mojo with young, smart, and overwhelmingly white computer fans translate into success at the voting booth? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we have several guests this hour, beginning with Dean campaign manager Joe Trippi, who's on the line from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Joe.
Dear.
Good to have you with us. I wonder if first you would listen with us to the pitch that Dean made to his supporters on Wednesday.
This is the first campaign in decades to be able to give the people a choice between a president who awards tax giveaways and government contracts to political contributors and a candidate who's owned by nobody except for you, the American people. Nobody else can claim that, and this opportunity is not possible because of what I did. It's possible because of what you did, and that is why we are asking you to decide. So today we're sending ballots to all of you who have joined the campaign, and you will vote on whether we should decline public financing or accept federal matching funds.
There, Joe, what made you decide to go this route?
Well, we have about 600,000 supporters nationwide now. Over 250,000 of them have made contributions to the campaign. They've gotten us to where we are today. And, you know, we decided that if the future of America rests in the hands of the American voter, the least we could do is put the future of our campaign in the hands of our supporters. And so we made this decision to throw it in their hands and let them vote on which way we should go. I mean, we really feel strongly that the only way to beat Bush, unfortunately, is because he's busted out of the campaign finance system, is to opt out as well. But in the end, it doesn't really matter what I want to do. It matters whether, you know, our supporters are going to make the decision. And they're voting. They voted yesterday, and they're voting today. And at midnight tonight, we'll close the vote off and announce the results tomorrow.
Can you tell us how it's going so far?
No.
Well, it was worth a try. What happens, though, if your supporters don't vote the way you want? This is kind of a double-edged sword, isn't it?
No, it's not. I think actually the most important thing about what we've done is that we've put the decision in our supporters' hands. They are our campaign, and so they can't make a wrong decision. If they vote to stay in the system, it says to me and the governor that had he made a decision to opt out, our own supporters wouldn't have been willing to carry the burden of funding this campaign against George Bush's millions and millions of dollars. So
basically you're asking them not just what do you think about this, but are you going to be there for us in terms of coming up with the money?
Exactly. And the one thing I can tell you is that you know, we've raised in pledges and money contributed during this vote. It's, you know, there's several million dollars being pledged or contributed right now online by the folks that are voting to go toe-to-toe with Bush. I mean, he's just got a huge advantage. They've raised $82 million already, and he's got about $77 million of that on hand. And they're talking about a goal of between $170 million to $250 million that they're going to use against a primary opponent they don't have. It's really a big problem for whoever the Democratic nominee is, particularly if you stay within a system that says you can only spend $45 million against that $250 million. I mean, it's a considerable advantage for Karl Rove, We don't want to give them that advantage. We hope our supporters agree with that. But it's going to be a big problem if for any Democrat if that's the situation we're faced with.
Joe, I think it's fair to say that Dean himself is not known as a real master of technology. So how is it that the campaign has been able to use the Internet so adroitly? I understand that you should probably take some credit for that.
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's a little bit of chicken and egg. I mean, so many people were finding us over the Internet when the governor made speeches at the DNC in February and I think in the California State Convention a few weeks later. We were a small campaign that just didn't have resources. And the governor kept coming back saying, Joe, we've got to run a decentralized campaign. We've got to figure out a way to get people all over the country where we don't have staff to use that energy and help us. And, you know, the Internet was the perfect way to do that. I keep saying there's only one way to compete with Bush's money. If we all held a big dinner tonight, and had 1,000 people show up and gave us $100, that'd be $100,000. If you did that for 10 nights, it'd be $1 million. For 100 nights, it'd be $10 million. If you did that for 1,000 nights, it'd be $100 million. If you did it for 2,000 nights, it'd be $200 million. So the good news is the Democratic Party could compete with Bush, but it would take us 6 years to do what I just talked about, having a dinner every night with average Americans giving $100. There's one medium in the world that would allow 2 million Americans to give $100 in one day if they decided to do it to get rid of George Bush, and that would be the Internet. It gives you the power to do that. And so that's what we're trying to reach out and talk to people about and let them understand. They really do, the American people really do have the power to get Bush out of there and to take their country back, but it's going to take a little bit more than just voting, a little bit more than just getting involved. They're going to have to get online and contribute $100.
And you see this, I would imagine, as a real transformation of how presidential politics in particular happen in America. I mean, the last figures I read, it's something like less than 1% of Americans actually give money to presidential campaigns, so this would be a completely different model.
No, it's about getting the American people involved in their democracy again and realizing that they can make a difference. I think one of the biggest hurdles for our campaign is to get enough people over their disbelief that their $25 or their $100 can actually change the country. And, you know, they're right if it's just, you know, they're one person doing that. But when you have, like we've built, when you have hundreds of thousands of people doing that, I think this can't, we've proven that it can be done. We raised $14.8 million in the last quarter that way. We believe we can compete with Bush if enough Americans understand that the stakes are high and that their small contribution in terms of time or money can make a huge difference.
Are you going to do this in terms of issues as well? I mean, why not throw out a poll saying, okay, you know, here's Dean's position on gun control. What do you folks think? And if they have a different take on it, would he change?
Well, I think the governor says that 80% of leadership is doing what the American people want. I mean, they pay your bills, they pay your pay, they elected you, they expect you to represent them. The other 20% of the time, leadership is taking a stand that you believe is right for the country and trying to bring people to your position. I think that's one of the stands he took when he opposed the war in Iraq. Obviously, the polling and everything, you know, and sort of where the country was much more supportive of going to war than Governor Dean was at the time. But he stood strong and stood against the war and believes we shouldn't be spending $87 billion over there without the president repealing the tax cuts that he's made to pay for it. If it's that important, let's sacrifice those tax cuts. And so, I mean, I think, again, yeah, we will be we believe this campaign is about having a great American conversation about many of the issues that confront the nation, whether it be on race or on the economy or our foreign policy. And we intend to continue that conversation and have it occur. We probably will do some of the things you're talking about having some sort of plebiscite on some issues over time. But again, a lot of it is also taking positions that even go that you're, even your own supporters don't agree with, but that you think are the right decision for the country, and try to get folks to change their view, to understand why we need to have a big debate and discussion about some of these issues.
Okay, Joe, not surprisingly, there are lots of people who want to talk to you. Let's go to our phone lines now and hear from Stanley, who's on the line from Cambridge. Hello, Stanley, and welcome.
Hi. Well, actually, I want to follow up on your very insightful comment and to elaborate a little bit. I agree with everything you said about the fundraising mechanisms, and in fact, so you know where I stand, I think the whole election process should be financed by everybody, $25 a throw, and make the whole thing an honest thing. But anyway, I am very nervous about, given that there's all so much information about how money is generated and what you said about the Republican, so on, that this should be a position where you educate your voter base about a position that you take, not a position where you poll people and maybe take a random response from people who may not understand all the issues and go with it. I'm nervous about not...
Okay, Stanley, we take your point. Joe, what about that?
Well, first of all, I agree with him that if we could publicly fund presidential campaigns, or the system needs to be changed, and it needs to be, we just got to get the special interest money out of the system. We believe that we're doing it, that we are public funding, that when 233,000 people contribute $77 to the Dean campaign, that's public financing. The American people right now, those that are supporting Howard Dean, are doing it without the special interest and basically, you know, removing them from our process. And we had 233,000 people contribute to us. Only 1,747 of those people contributed the maximum amount of $2,000.
In terms of the decision making, though, I can remember Clinton getting a lot of flack from a lot of people about government by polling. So,
we're not polling. I mean, we're not. This isn't a poll. This is a vote. I mean, we're going to abide by the decision of our supporters on this one. And I think there's a real misunderstanding of our campaign. The people that are carrying us are our campaign. I mean, the fact is, you have all these guys in Washington that have all this experience, but their experience has gotten us to where we are today, and it's not that great a place. You can depend on a guy who's going to ride up to Washington on a white horse and solve all your problems. You know, that ain't going to happen either. The Constitution and our founding documents put the power to change this country where it rightly belongs, in the hands of the American people. And so this isn't about somebody with Washington experience. It's not about a guy on a white horse that's going to ride up there and change the country. It's us. It's the American people that have to change it. We have to get involved. We have to participate. We have to vote. We have to contribute to change it. And if we do that, then you're going to have health care for every American, because...
Joe, we have to go. Thank you so much for being with us. We appreciate it. We're talking this hour about the Dean campaign's use of the Internet. And in just a moment, after we take a break, we'll be listening to two other experts on the issue. So stay with us. Let me ask in the meantime, do you see this as an example for real grassroots democracy? Is it about the issues, or is it about socializing and the cult of personality? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Gail Harris, and this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the Internet aspect of Howard Dean's campaign. Earlier this week, Governor Dean asked his supporters to vote online whether the campaign should opt out of the federal campaign funding system. And we have two more folks we want to hear from. First, joining us this hour from San Francisco is Gary Wolf. He's a contributing editor to Wired magazine, and these days he's finishing an article for Wired on the Internet aspect of Dean's campaign. Welcome, Gary.
Thank you.
And also joining us is Ryan Lizza. He is an associate editor at The New Republic and covers the presidential campaign, and he's on the line from Washington. Hi, Ryan.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thanks. Let me throw it to you first, Ryan, because you were listening, as we were, to Joe Trippi a moment ago. Is this as different as he's making it sound? Is this a new community of energized voters who are taking part in new and exciting ways? Or is this just kind of a variation on the theme? We've seen campaigns with true believers before. How different is this?
Well, it is fundamentally different than anything we've seen before in politics. And, if you want to be cynical about it, you could say, well, that Joe Trippi and Howard Dean know exactly what they want out of this vote. And if you read their appeal to their 600,000 voters, it wasn't exactly an unbiased presentation of both sides of the argument.
They were being nudged.
Yeah, they were being nudged. But, having said that, no other campaigns don't do this. I mean, campaigns don't put things up for a vote. Campaigns don't cede control to the whims of their supporters.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing that they're doing it?
I think it's a good thing. I mean, I think it's as controlling as they're being over it, and as stacked as the deck is, it's pretty radical. I mean, you talk to these other campaigns, and they just wouldn't for a second think of doing something like this. Campaigns don't give control over to their supporters. On the other hand, there's a very practical reason they're doing it. As Joe said when you interviewed him, they want to find out if their people are going to still stick with them if they do this. If they find out that their 600,000 supporters say no, we really believe in this campaign finance system. You told us at the beginning of this campaign that you did too. We can't believe you're backtracking on that position. They'd want to know that. So I think it has a practical part of it as well.
Gary, I want to bring you in as well on this point. Do you see this as the new technology that's going to make the same kind of difference that we saw television make in the 1960 presidential campaign?
Oh, I think so, or more. And I think Ryan is right on the subject of this plebiscite that they're holding. They are pretty sure what the result is going to be, and they are throwing it open to their supporters in part as a way of strengthening the bond they have with those supporters. And I don't think they're taking a huge risk that their supporters are going to, say, opt out of campaign financing. But, again, Ryan is right. No one has done this before. And the consequences of doing this last longer than, the period of this vote. And they go beyond even whether they're going to take, accept the limits or blow out of them, because they're learning how to communicate with their supporters. And they're training their supporters to feel that they have a right to communicate with the campaign. And these are things that are very hard to do. And even holding the plebiscite is hard, and figuring out, that nobody is going to vote twice, and that people aren't jumping onto the campaign so they can vote, and that people who've signed up for the campaign who support other candidates don't, skew the vote. Mm. These are all things that they're practicing. And I think in a way, if you look at it as something that's going to be unfolding possibly for years, it makes sense to start this with something that, you feel that you have a pretty good understanding of where your membership stands, where your supporter stands, and you can try it out and you can see if it works and you can get a bunch of publicity. But I wouldn't expect this to end here. I mean, we don't know what's coming, but it's something very interesting.
Ryan, what about Dean's pledge 8 months ago to accept the public campaign funds and the spending limits that come with those? We've seen just yesterday John Kerry accusing him of now trying to weasel out of that agreement. Joe Lieberman said that Dean would be inconsistent if he opts out now. And you have to wonder, is this just sour grapes of, gosh, why didn't I think of this? Or do they have a point?
I think it's both. It's sour grapes, and they do have a point. He did make a statement that he was committed to this system, and just like any other candidate would do, after discovering that that he could raise millions of dollars in a way that no one ever has before, he decided that a position 8 months ago wasn't so smart. And it's, all of these candidates would do exactly the same thing. And the truth is that the public financing system is pretty broken, and it's not going to be fixed this cycle. And there's, he's definitely being a little bit hypocritical, but these candidates would be lying if they told you they wouldn't be doing the exact same thing.
All right, let's go to our phone lines now and hear from Robert, who's calling from Burlington, Vermont. Hi, Robert.
Hi. I just want to kind of dispel an old demographic that 18 to 24-year-olds don't vote. I think we're going to find out that that's going to be different this election, and here's why. I'm not in that category. I'm 47, and I have some still reasonable hope that there's going to be something left for my retirement in 2013 or whatever it is. But for these kids who are 18 to 24 years old, they are looking at what Bush is doing as a direct transfer of wealth from them, from their retirement, to Bush's rich, fat cat friends, to this war, to all this other stuff. And they're mad as hell, and they know how to use the Internet.
I was going to say, and you think it's the Internet that's really given them that voice and that means of communicating what they think.
Well, of course. But what's motivating them? Why it's not that Howard Dean, you know, magically thought up this Internet thing. It's that he has a message that resonates with people of this demographic. And that's what's going to beat Bush.
All right. Thank you so much for the call, Robert. Let me put that one to you, Gary. Is it the medium, or is it the message, or is it both?
Well, there's a number of questions contained in there, but I think just to address maybe what the core is, who is online and how are they affecting the Dean campaign, and are they representative of the people who are actually going to choose who becomes the next president? I think there's a lot of misunderstanding of that. I don't have the statistics from the campaign about what the average age of the supporters is, the people who signed up, but I expect that the numbers skew much older than people are saying, and that we're not talking about a bunch of 18 to 25-year-olds or even 18 to 30-year-olds. I suspect that the range is fairly broad, and the average, or, you know, there's a number of different ways to take an average, but I suspect you're looking at people in their 30s and 40s and even in their 50s. I don't think there's a lot of 19-year-olds or 21-year-olds or even 25-year-olds who are writing $100 checks to this campaign. It would surprise me greatly. Second, I think that there's also a misunderstanding that people who get information from the Internet are in a way isolated from everybody else in the population. So they can exchange emails with each other and they can go on websites, but, you know, everybody else remains oblivious to everything that they're thinking about. I think that's obviously untrue. Some people use the Internet, other people don't. But the people who do use the Internet are linked in the larger social network that we all live in. So it's sort of like somebody hears something on the radio. Well, that doesn't mean that things that are on the radio only affect people who listen to the radio. Of course they don't. And the Dean campaign is exploring what I think are some really interesting intersections, not within the Internet, but between the Internet and people who are not on the Internet. And, you know, just to take the one that everybody talks about, we have to remember that Meetup, which was really the beginning of the Dean Internet campaign, does not take place on the Internet. Meetup is a tool on the Internet that people use to sign up to go meet people face-to-face out in bars and restaurants. I've been to some of them. I went to one in a Unitarian church, you know, with 60 people in it a year before the election. And those people, you know, bring their friends, etc. So my interest, which is really not completely on the political side, really, but on the structural side and on the media side, I don't see this as something that's happening inside the Internet. I see it as a very interesting exploitation of the links between the Internet and the larger social world, which everybody lives in.
Ryan, do you see this as sort of a perfect storm in politics, a lot of factors coming together to create this very powerful tool, and the other candidates are just kind of standing back and trying to figure out how they can capitalize on it, too?
Yeah, yeah. And to go back to what you said a second ago about the Internet being a collection of people that are alienated versus a medium that sort of brings people together, I remember early on in the campaign when the Dean campaign was very effective at sort of generating a lot of stories about what they were doing online, because all of us campaign reporters were totally fascinated by it. A senior advisor to one of the other candidates, when I asked him about this Meetup phenomenon that we were all talking about, he dismissively said, "Oh, yeah, you ever been to one of these things? You know, it's like the bar scene at Star Wars."
I bet they're wishing for their own bar scene about now.
Yeah, exactly. You know, the idea was that it's a bunch of geeks and sort of, you know, socially inept people that sort of get together and talk about this bizarre Vermont governor. You know, and of course, a couple of months later, that campaign has been doing absolutely everything they can to copy what Dean is doing on the Internet. And one other thing I wanted to point out, you were talking about, you know, the medium, is the medium the message here? And I think that's one one thing that the Dean campaign needs to worry about is a lot of the stuff we write and see and read about the campaign is about the technology. It's about all these cool things they're doing, all the bells and whistles. You know, Governor Dean gave a long speech the other day about the campaign finance system. And to a certain extent, I think all of that moves them a little bit away from talking about issues that, you know, actually matter to ordinary people, you know, his health care plan and the other things he wants to do actually as president. So sometimes when you read about the Dean campaign, it does seem like the medium is the message, and they sort of move a little bit away from the issues.
I'd like to say something about that, what Ryan just said, which I think is very interesting, because there you see someplace where perhaps the medium is going to change politics fundamentally. There was a lot of discussion about Clinton's brilliance in putting together a patchwork of issues that brought in different constituencies and building, you know, a winning coalition. Now, I'm not a political reporter. I didn't cover that campaign, but I do notice that that is an approach that is completely different than the approach that Dean is taking. Dean is identifying a couple of very vivid positions, just a few. He talks about the war, obviously. He says repeal the whole Bush tax cut. He says let's get, you know, health care to everybody. He lets the details, you know, he may put out information about the details of his policies, but his supporters don't absorb that information. This isn't a patchwork of kind of issues, of constituencies brought together by different issues. This is the whole structure of the campaign is different. And I think the internet is what's allowing him to do that, allowing him to put himself out there with a few things and let people come to him.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. And we invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And let's go to Needham now, Needham, Massachusetts, where Dennis is on the line. Hello, Dennis.
Hello. I want to second what your guest said about the internet campaigning of Dean, bringing people together, not just keeping them in their isolation. I was originally attracted to Dean as much for his campaign, the way his campaign was being run, as to the man himself. And since I registered with the campaign, I've gone up to New Hampshire and canvassed door-to-door. I've gone to meetups. I've worked as a volunteer on phone banks, calling other Dean supporters. I've handed out leaflets in Copley Square. I have never, and of course I've contributed money, I've never done any of those things for any other candidate, and I'm at the senior and cynical end of the voter demographic. So
what's drawing you in, Dennis? What is it that's appealing to you to the point that you're willing to spend this much time?
Well, it's the man, obviously, and the campaign and his use of the internet is a reflection of the man. It's honest and it's open and it's something that I believe in, and getting people to believe in politicians and politics is a noble goal and an absolutely necessary goal for this country. And people are just being turned away more and more, and he's drawing them back in. And I think that's going to become so evident as the primary season's just. You know, the Me Too candidates who are going to be putting up their Me Too websites, they're all just going to fall by the wayside because people just really believe in Howard Dean. The level of enthusiasm that I've found meeting with people and talking with people, most of whom are much younger than I am, and are willing to just get out there and work it because they really believe in something, you know, it's very energizing for me, very encouraging.
How old
Dennis?
Are the people you're seeing?
Pardon?
How old are the people you're seeing that you're working with on the campaign?
Oh, I'd say mid-20s. The organizers, I've volunteered for the Mass for Dean organization, and they gave me a list of names to call people. And just from talking to them on the phone, you know, I could say that they were probably, you know, post-college graduate, under 30, kinds of folks. But when I went canvassing, the people that I was canvassing with up in New Hampshire, some of them were older than me. You know, a couple drove all the way up to Derry from Western Mass, and they looked like they were in their 70s. and we're going to spend the weekend campaigning. So it's not isolated, and it's not a narrow demographic, and it's not just sort of position politics. I think people really believe in the man.
Got it, Dennis, and we thank you so much for the call. Gary, let me ask you about that. I mean, how is this encouraging that young people are getting excited and that it, but it's not just young people. As Dennis said, it seems to be crossing some demographic lines here.
Well, you know, I've been looking at how the Internet campaign has been working, and one of the things I find really interesting, as I said, is the intersection between the Internet side of the campaign and the larger aspects of the campaign. I think there is one place where it's very much full of very young people, and that is in the tools creation part of the campaign. If you're asking who is putting up the websites, who is designing these neat mechanisms by which you can click on a button and find out if there are any other Dean supporters who live in your zip code, for instance. You know, these are tools that are being designed by young people. And I think that the web does have a tendency to fragment into isolated regions, and that there's some technical structural reasons for that. On the web, if you link somewhere, it's a one-way link. There's not an automatic link back. And in the structure of networks, networks with one-way links tend to fragment into isolated regions. But what the campaign has done is exploit the fact that in a network like the web, well, there's one more feature I want to mention. In a network like the web, first movers, people who do things first, get a huge advantage. And there's also structural reasons for that. And those advantages compile over time. And the relationship between the most popular websites and the next most popular websites it follows a very steep curve. There is no way any of the other candidates are ever going to catch up with Dean on the web. And that is not only a product of what he's done, but it's a product of the structure and the nature of the web. It will be impossible. Now, that doesn't mean that they can't catch up with him in the election, you know, because the web is a relatively small portion of the electorate participates in the political web. But what they're doing is they're exploiting their lead on the web to translate that into success out there in the world. And that's where the thing becomes absolutely interesting, because then you're moving into a field where it's not primarily young people. You're moving into a field where they're not isolated regions.
Connection listeners, can Howard Dean translate the internet buzz around him into a victory at the primaries? Are this campaign's innovative techniques applicable for other candidates and other campaigns? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection. We're talking this hour about the Howard Dean campaign and the implication for American politics of the work on the internet for the campaign. Can you see this working for Republicans as well? Is this mostly a tactic, or is it a model for campaigns to come? With me this hour is Ryan Lizza, who covers the presidential campaign for The New Republic, and Gary Wolf, who's writing an article for Wired magazine on the Dean campaign. And if you'd like to join us in the conversation, our number is 1-800-423-8255. Ryan, let me put that question to you. Why can't the Republicans do this just as easily as Dean has?
Well, you know what? I think they actually get this more than people realize. If you look at what the RNC has done over the last few years since Bush came into office, it's not quite the same. There's not as much of an online community, a sort of very visible online community, as there is with the Dean campaign. But the whole strategy of the RNC since 2000 is to increase person-to-person voter contact, to get away from using television as the essential advertising medium for candidates, to get back to grassroots campaigning. And it hasn't received as much attention, but the RNC has literally restructured themselves to organize in that way. They have massive email lists of millions of voters. They've really gone back and done a lot of the sort of old-fashioned kind of campaigning. They've instituted something called the 72-hour task force, which is all about organizing people on the ground. So to the extent that the Dean campaign is about using technology to return to grassroots politics, the Republicans have really been doing this.
Gary, let me put it to you. If television took politics from the grassroots, which is what Joe Trippi, the Dean campaign manager, believes, can the Internet give it back?
Well, I think it can. And I think, you know, what I was listening carefully to what Ryan was saying, and it interests me because I don't know or follow what the Republican side has been doing, you know, in terms of their campaign strategy. But I've assumed that they've been paying attention. And, you know, on the net, the Republican voice is heard loud and clear. I mean, my impression is that while Dean has basically crushed the competition on the Democratic side, you know, he's facing a pretty worthy opponent on the Republican side. And, you know, we haven't seen it to any great extent simply because there's no real primary campaign. And, you know, but in a real battle to see who can use the Internet to win an election, I don't think I don't think there's any evidence that the Democrats are necessarily going to be stronger than the Republicans.
Let's go to Acton, Massachusetts now and hear from Judy on this point. Judy, you're involved in the Dean campaign, I understand. Do you think this could work just as well for the Republicans?
I don't know. I guess my personal experience is that the Internet has been a tool to get that grassroots energy going. It's a communication tool more than anything else. There are a lot of people perhaps who get into the blogs and all that stuff. I don't have time for that. You know, I've got small kids. I'm starting a business. I'm just too crazy in my life to do that. But, you know, by staying in touch with the email, and there's conference calls with Joe Trippi to keep us up to date on what we need to be communicating to the people at the meetups. The meetups are not social. They're work. We go, we talk about the issues, and we discuss those, but we also, you know, talk about how important it is to canvass, and we write letters, personal letters. Each of us the other night wrote two letters to undecided voters in New Hampshire or Iowa. At the meetup I went to, we had 25 letters that I sent off in the mail that night that were handwritten by people.
So Judy, this sounds like just regular grassroots politics, no?
It is. It's the, you know, that's the thing that's so exciting, is that people feel empowered in his campaign. They feel like they're taking part, and all they have to do, I started a meetup in Acton because the other ones were too far away, so I went to meetup and I said, you know, I want one in Acton. It got enough votes, so it happened, and there I was running a meetup, you know? And I decided to support Dean based on hearing him speak. I heard seven of the candidates speak, and he was the one who struck me as having the most integrity, the most compassion, and really a thoughtful approach to the issues, as opposed to a knee-jerk response. He had all the things that I wanted to see in terms of characteristics of a candidate. And so then I went to the Internet and sent off a check, and then I started getting the emails. And I never donated to a campaign before, you know, but I think for me it was like, okay, I can't give $2,000, but I can give something, and I'm now give money every month, you know, and they make it easy for people to feel like, yes, you can make a difference.
All right. Yeah. Judy, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks.
Yep.
And I want to hear from Gary and Ryan also on this, the E word, the empowerment. That's certainly something that you hear a lot about from this campaign. Gary, you want to start?
Well, I have just been finishing up a popular book on election history written in the 30s called Torchlight Parade. And I picked it up because I thought that's a bizarre title for a book about politics. Torchlight Parade, you know, what does a torchlight parade have to do with it? And, you know, I learned from that book that popular gatherings, small and large, were an essential part of presidential politics, not just local politics, going back to the founding, you know, and to the battles between Adams and Jefferson. But it ended with the advent of television, which is interesting because the book was written in the 30s, you know, so, you know, it's right before the age of great, you know, popular mass communication. You know, I think that it's clear that what the Internet is doing is bringing face-to-face social contact, torchlight parades type activity back into a presidential campaign. And I think that's extremely significant. And that's why I think anybody who thinks about this as simply a way to get a bunch of pasty-faced geeks to write checks so that you can buy television commercials.
Well, let's not call them that.
Yeah, it's, well, you know, this is the kind of thing that you hear, I think, is really missing the point. And I think, you know, candidates who treat it that way, you know, are going to find themselves on the sidelines. I don't think the Republicans will treat it that way simply because you look on the internet and you see what they're already doing.
Yeah, Ryan, yeah. It sounds, as I'm listening to all of this, as if it's almost like a wheel model. You know, you have a leader at the center, and then you have all kinds of spokes going off in their own directions. Can the center keep all of those spokes together?
That's a good question. I mean, you, for all of the mass audience that Dean has built, it's still. A lot of the campaign is still centralized in Burlington, and it does sort of have the original core staff. I think they were very lucky that they started with you know, a sort of compelling candidate and someone who's and a sort of a campaign manager like Trippi, who sort of got understood the internet because of his background in Silicon Valley. And what they were able to do as they sort of slowly added these grassroots components on, they could sort of figure out as the campaign grew to deal with the growth. I think which is a good comparison is the Clark campaign, which started with this massive draft movement, and then Clark jumped in the race, and he had all of these self-declared leaders, and he didn't really know what to do with them, and they weren't able to sort of cobble together the Clark campaign with the grassroots. And I think it's important that Dean started out very small and was able to deal with all the growth and was able to deal with all the sort of innovation that the campaign added as they went along.
You're listening
to... Can I ask Dean the other...
Hold on 1 second. I just need to tell everybody that you're listening to The Connection from NPR. Okay, Gary, go ahead.
Yes, I asked Dean last week what he intends to do with this mechanism, you know, when he... either wins or loses his campaign, because I think you do have people who have, to use your word, been empowered, you know, but maybe a better way to look at it is simply who have discovered an aspect of their lives, a political engagement in their lives that they're not going to want to give up. His answer was very interesting, especially for what it implies for the future of the Democratic Party. You know, he gave a very combative answer. He's a combative guy. He said, well, you know, the fight against the right wing doesn't end with this election. The right's made a lot of strides in America. They have both houses of Congress. They're making progress in the judiciary. We're going to go on and fight the right for years. Well, okay, that's a good, strong political answer. But it made me wonder, wow, I mean, is this the infrastructure of the Democratic Party heading into the future? And what do the people who run the Democratic Party now think of that? Because, you know, maybe they're stuck with it. Maybe all these local groups and, you know, who have their own orientation and their own leadership, maybe this is the Democratic Party of the future.
Hmm. Let's go to Scarsdale, New York next and hear from Alan, who's on the line. Hi, Alan. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to add something that I think hasn't been mentioned in this conversation, and I think it's an important aspect of why the Dean campaign has resonated so through the web and what the importance is of the web in modern politics in reversing, I think, a negative trend that's been the result of television. People who go to the web for news are just that, people who are seeking out news, and they're readers. They're not passively receiving something that was delivered over the airwaves, and they're not receiving their news as sound bites or the two or three sentences that an average story gets on the evening news. They're people who are essentially reading an unlimited number of newspapers of choice and jumping from article to article to article for more depth. Those are the people who seek out their news on the web. That's something they couldn't have done before. And that's empowered a lot of us to receive information unfiltered. Not only do we have our choice of newspaper to be delivered to our houses like everybody else, but we have our choice of newspapers from across the country. If I want to follow up a story and see what the Brits think about it, I can go to the London Times, I can go to the Daily Telegraph. If I want to read what the French think about it, I can do what otherwise political operatives used to do with clipping services, and they only received that days later. And that's typical
of large numbers of people I've spoken with who go to the web because they want to receive news from different sources and make their own decisions. That's a different kind of person, but that's a person who's a potential community leader. Certainly that's a person who's a potential community idea leader.
All right, Alan, we thank you so much for the call. Appreciate your point. Ryan, what about that? And also, as a political reporter, do you feel as if the Alans of the world are going to kind of take over your job? They're getting information from a lot of different sources.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, one of the things that the whole blog culture has revealed to a lot of people in my profession is that it's not that hard to do political analysis. And there are a lot of fantastic upstart political analysts out there that have started their own blogs, and you know, just because they don't have a job at some named newspaper or magazine doesn't mean that they're just as good as a lot of the talking heads you see on TV. And a lot of those people are read really widely by all the so-called insiders now. And you know, in that sense, the internet it's one aspect where the internet really does live up to its reputation as empowering people.
Gary, do you see a downside here in terms of whether Dean's support is wide but not deep? I mean, could these people at some point get disillusioned and look elsewhere for a candidate?
Well, there's two ways of looking at a downside, whether there's a downside for Dean and whether there's a downside as far as I'm concerned. You know, certainly I think there are potential pitfalls for Dean. You know, and he's going to have to manage this very complicated campaign, he and Joe Trippi, and I wish them the best of luck. I think there's absolutely no downside, you know, from the larger perspective to what's happening. I think it's absolutely great. I think it's even bigger than people have yet been able to realize. And I think every single, you know, politician and maybe ultimately every citizen is going to have their political life changed by this.
It is fascinating, isn't it? Gentlemen, we thank you so much. Gary Wolf, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Ryan Lizza, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Look forward to hearing from more from you on the campaign trail. Gary Wolf is contributing editor to Wired magazine, and Ryan Lizza is an associate editor at The New Republic, who's been covering the presidential campaigns. Earlier this hour, we spoke with Joe Trippi, campaign manager for Howard Dean. You can continue the conversation on our website, theconnection.org. We had help today from Glenn Alexander and Matt Largy. The Connection is produced by Khalil Bird, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Arit Koritsky-Fox, Jen Mattson, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugarts. Our producer in Baghdad is Mark Allard. Our intern is Sarah Ligon. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon, and this is The Connection from NPR.